Welcome to AZMcast, a peer-reviewed, evidence-based podcast heavily seasoned with expert opinion. For all you new listeners, I'm going to give you a quick tutorial on how to use this podcast to its fullest potential. For you faithful veterans, you can go ahead and skip ahead to the good stuff. As you listen to this podcast, you'll hear contributors give opinions on everything from practice styles to diagnostic evaluations to emergency medicine philosophy. When you hear the bell ding, that means that the opinion is backed by evidence. Check your screen on your device to see the reference paper, and we suggest taking a screenshot for future reading. When you hear the turkey gobble, that's just our opinion, and you can decide whether you want to take it or leave it. Hi, everybody, and welcome to the November episode of AZMcast. Let's take a trip down memory lane to probably one of the first things you ever learned in school. Share and don't eat the glue. Good life lessons from kindergarten. Anyway, let's go on a bit further to when you learned about the parasympathetic and sympathetic nervous systems and the dreaded cholinergic crisis caused by insecticides or other organophosphates. Now, the sludge or dumbbells mnemonic is probably one of the first things you were taught in medical school. And yet, how many times have you actually seen this in your ED? It would not take me long to say everything I know about cholinergic syndrome, so I recruited some help. This month on the show, we're joined by the always pleasant, always complimentary, and always thorough Dr. Frank Walter, toxicologist extraordinaire. Dr. Walter walks us through a real case he had and helps us to break down the evidence for how we manage these patients. And for any of you who know him, see if you can count how many Walterisms are crammed into this hour. Trust but verify this episode of AZMcast on organophosphate toxicity. Good morning, Frank. How are you?
Good morning, Aaron. I'm doing well. Thank you.
So this month, we have one of our faculty, one of our professors of toxicology, emergency medicine, et cetera, Dr. Frank Walter, who is going to be talking to us about something that you learned probably in your first week of medical school as part of your neurophysiology, but probably have never actually seen in real life, which is organophosphate toxicity, or that cholinergic syndrome that you learned when you were learning about your parasympathetic and your sympathetic drives. So, Frank, welcome.
Thank you very much, Aaron. It's a pleasure to be here.
Very nice to have you. So for any of you that have heard Dr. Walter speak before, you know that he has a very succinct, well-thought-out way to do these, approach these things, that especially in tox are the things that you won't see all the time unless you're a toxicologist or you work in a place where people are constantly being poisoned. So we really appreciate you coming on. Frank, amongst his other accolades, runs the Advanced Hazmat Life Support course, which along with ATLS and APLS and PALS and ACLS is another advanced course for life-saving interventions. But specifically, this is for toxicologic exposure, envenomations, poisonings. Frank, would you tell us a little more about AHLS?
Sure. Thanks for having me, Aaron. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm the editor for Advanced Hazmat Life Support, and we're actually celebrating the 20th anniversary of the founding of this course.
Congratulations.
Well, thank you very much. It's a very much a group effort, a international group of clinical toxicologists worldwide, emergency physicians, occupational medicine, and very interdisciplinary for medics, nurses, docs, pharmacists, advanced practice practitioners, etc. And we've trained about 20,000 folks from 78 countries around the world. The course has been translated into German, Spanish, also Portuguese and Dutch, and also basic hazmat life support in Arabic. So what we'll talk about today is actually distilled out of the advanced hazmat life support courses.
So this is a little bit of a sample. If someone would want to take one of the courses, this is a little bit of what you might get, minus my trying to figure out my own way in this by asking you questions.
Oh, you're doing great, Aaron. You're being extremely modest. So it's my privileged to be here with you.
Great. So for anyone that is interested in doing it, how would they find out more about AHLS?
So there's a 16-hour provider course, and there are 4-hour shorter courses on toxic terrorism, toxic products of combustion, those sort of things. And you just go to hls.org. So if you just type in hls.org into any search engine, you'll find us there.
Great. Who do you think this course would be ideal for?
Of the 20,000 folks that have taken it, about 43% are paramedics, about 24% are physicians, about 22% nurses, about 2-3% pharmacists, and then other interdisciplinary healthcare professionals, respiratory therapists, industrial hygienists, etc. So it's really good for anybody who takes care of patients that have been exposed to hazardous materials or dangerous goods, from point of contact in the pre-hospital system, through the emergency department, through the wards, ICUs, rehab.
Great.
Caring for patients is a team sport, as we all know, and so this is anybody that's on the team that takes care of patients exposed to hazardous materials or dangerous goods.
Great, and it's nice to have everybody on the team reading from the same playbook, too. So.
Exactly.
Great. So we're going to run through a case, and this is a real case, correct?
This is a real case, absolutely.
Okay. So the case is going to be a 23-year-old depressed and suicidal man who drank diazinon. And so right off the bat, I'm confused, and I'm going to be calling poison control, as I often do. And the poison control number for anyone across the country is
1-800-222-1222. So in the U.S., it's a toll-free number, 1-800, and then it's a palindrome, 222-1222.
Easy enough to remember. And so I'm looking at this patient drinking something that I know is not supposed to be imbibed and trying to figure out what to do next with them. But for an initial approach, you've got a few things spelled out here. So the roommates find him difficult to awaken. He has no past medical histories, no allergy, no asthma, according to the roommates. And on exam, he has a respiratory rate of 18 with wheezes, a heart rate of 98, a blood pressure of 140 over 90, a temperature of 37.1 Celsius, and a GCS of 12. So that's the case you have in front of you. And already I'm hoping that my toxicologist is coming in to relieve me, to kind of help me out with this case.
Be happy to. Obviously, we check out to each other in the emergency department on a routine basis. So I always appreciate getting your help too, Aaron.
That is one of the nice things, I think, with fellowships in emergency medicine is at your core, you still have to be an emergency doctor. I think that that's very unique with the fellowships that we do, that a toxicologist, a sports medicine specialist, EMS, ultrasound, everybody at their core still has to be good at emergency medicine, which means that we kind of speak each other's language to a degree. Just some of us are more fluent than others. So.
Yes.
Okay. So differentials on this patient was something that you suggested. So I was thinking about this after we kind of looked over the case, and this is going to be any of my altered mental status kind of workup, but specifically not knowing what this chemical is on its own, I'm looking at some of the source and I'm seeing a patient with wheezes. And so my first thought, before I knew the outcome of this case and knowing what we were going to talk about, would have been maybe this is hydrocarbon, maybe this is some kind of organophosphate, maybe this is something else that's going to be primary lung toxic just because of the wheezes. But nothing else jumps out to me except for the fact that he's altered. Other considerations that you would say?
For me, long ago I learned the AEIOU TIPS differential diagnosis for altered mental status. So I think that's a good place to start. As we many have learned over the years, different things in the AAIU TIPS differential, alcohols, plural, usually ethanol, but it could be other alcohols, airway troubles with respiratory acidosis or hypercarbia causing decreased mental status, ammonia excess, E for ethanol, a specific alcohol that would be most common, E also for epilepsy, either a non-convulsive seizure or a postictal state. E for electrolytes, probably the most common ones that would cause altered mental status, hypercalcemia, or either potentially hyper or hyponatremia. Endocrine, obviously a whole list there, or encephalitis. I for insulin excess or deficiency with hyperglycemia or hypoglycemia. O for OD. That list could be hundreds or thousands of things long.
Yeah.
Opioids, obviously, with the current opioid epidemic in the United States, a very tragic cause of death. O also for oxygen deficiency. U for uremia, other metabolic diseases. Three T's, trauma, so neurotrauma. Temperature extremes, either hyper or hypothermic, T for brain tumor. New I for infections, either systemic with sepsis, part of the QSOFA criteria, altered mental status, or CNS infections. We already mentioned encephalitis above. This could also be meningitis. P is for poisons. Again, that list could be long. The other P is a diagnosis of exclusion. And we always need to be sure that we've ruled out other things before we say this is in somebody's head in the psychiatric sense of that.
That's why the P is silent.
That's right. Okay. And S for shock, stroke, and seizure. So that broad differential. Here, then, the other clue, as you said, was what causes bronchospasm or wheezing? Allergic reactions are possible. Beta blockers, brevetoxin, something unusual that causes neurotoxic shellfish poisoning. Carbamates, which are also insecticides that can cause cholinergic crisis, but do not irreversibly bind to the acetylcholinesterase. Chlorine and other irritant gases, such as ammonia, etc. Hydrocarbon and substituted hydrocarbon aspiration. If this person drank down diazinon, it's usually in a hydrocarbon diluent or excipient, so he could have aspiration pneumonitis. Isocyanates are true allergy causers. Solid aerosols, dust, smokes, fumes, and sulfites would all be things that could cause bronchospasm.
Now, I wanted to go back real quick to one of the things you mentioned on AEIOU tips, which is oxygen deficiency. And I think that's one that I underestimated as a cause of altered mental status. But over the years, as I've seen patients have air hunger, that initially you weren't quite certain what was going on with them, but you noticed that they were air hungry, that degree of altered mental status, it's a severe agitation that I didn't appreciate until I'd seen it a few times. And it's not just that they can't get oxygen into their lungs. It's often, I've seen it in cases of shock as well, where they can't deliver oxygen to their tissue and they have poor brain perfusion and they are really aggressive, pulling at their clothes, trying to get out of bed. And it's a case where I wouldn't think so much, wow, something... this patient probably needs more oxygen. I would be thinking, well, they're having the psychotic episode. They have something that needs a CT scan. We need to hurry up and sedate them. I think that that's one to kind of jump out to people. When you've seen that of a patient that's in bad shock and they are air hungry, they have this kind of particular way about them that they're very pressured in their speech, and they're kind of pulling at things, and they're just generally trying to get as much oxygen in as possible. So I think that that's one that's underrated for the altered mental status differential.
Yes. I quite agree. Oxygen deficiency and shock are carotid aortic chemoreceptors. When they sense diminished oxygen or extreme acidosis, that's going to trigger off an afferent signal to the brain, and brain's going to say fight or flee. And you've got an impaired patient that's trying to fight or flee in bed, is really what you're describing. So, this is the case. It's a real case. If you don't know what diazinon is, and there are lots of chemicals out there, it's good to call the Poison Center, as you said, 1-800-222-1222, and they'll let you know this is an organophosphate insecticide.
Yeah.
So then the question is really, we've got somebody with altered mental status, bronchospasm, wheezing. How do you want to evaluate and treat this person? This is your patient. And what physical exam signs will you search for? What will help you here?
So I think that you've got your initial approach to every patient, which is your airway, breathing, circulation, disability, dextrose exposure, and I think that that's a great way to approach anybody. There's a few specific things that I wonder if you could comment on that's useful to from a toxicology standpoint. Specifically, the toxicologist handshake and looking for clonus.
Okay. Toxicology handshake. Now we'd rather have gloves on so that we can't feel the wetness or dryness in people's axillae. But again, yeah, we want to look at skin. Is it well perfused? Are they sweaty? Do they have focal sweating or diffuse sweating? Focal sweating can occur just from topical application of these agents. The other question that you had was Clonus. So many people now are on SSRIs and SNRIs that altered mental status, I'm going to check tone in the lower extremities, and to do that with the patient supine, I'll ask them to please relax their legs as much as possible if they can cooperate, and I'll lift their knee towards the ceiling. Normal tone in the lower extremities, the heel will slide along the bed. Increased tone, whether it's due to serotonin syndrome, usually due to a drug-drug interaction, or whether it's due to spasticity from some other upper motor neuron lesion, cord or brain or otherwise, the heel will come off the bed. And also then Clonus, up to 3 beats of Clonus in the ankles is normal, but more than that is surely abnormal. And so again, altered mental status, again with the frequency of people on SSRIs and SNRIs, we as emergency physicians, if we look for this, I see just de novo in the emergency department about one case a quarter with this. Any other, does that address the question?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that there's a few things when we're going through an altered mental status patient that we go that's even above and beyond a patient that is sick with a focal finding. When they're just undifferentiated altered mental status, we really have to look broadly. And I think that some of these other findings aren't something that we would necessarily check on a patient that came in with respiratory distress with the urgency that we would check in an altered mental status patient. So for physical exam, we've got a patient that won't sit up for us, has a GCS of 12. The skin is sweaty and shows fasciculations. The pupils are 1 millimeters bilaterally, and there's a frothy white saliva and sputum coming from the mouth. And the patient is dyspneic. They're wheezing, and they're kind of inspiratory to expiratory ratios 1 to 3. The neuro exam on a patient that won't cooperate, often a little bit difficult, is I'll start with a painful stimulus, and if they wake up and they're talking to me, that kind of helps right away. And if they won't, then I know I've got a patient that's much sicker. Sometimes I'll just shout to patients and see if they'll respond. But generally, if you've got someone as ill as this patient appears to be, I want to know at least, are they going to respond or hopefully localize to a painful stimulus before I start determining if I need to do anything else. You have a great approach to just a general neuro exam in the ED, which can be done really quickly after practicing it for a while. And I'm going to try to squeeze as many Frank Walterisms into this podcast as I can. So tell us about your approach to the neuro exam in the ED.
Sure. This goes back to med school. As the twig is bent, the tree will grow. And we had some neurologists teaching us at Washington University in St. Louis. They had a little book, and it said, if we call you at 3 a.m. 10 years hence, without becoming fully awake, you'll be able to recite the 9-part neuro exam. So they consist of mental status, station and gait, skull and spine, because we as emergency physicians are examining the entire patient. They may or may not have trauma. Meninges, cranial nerves, motor, sensory, reflexes, and coordination, including finger, nose, finger, heel, knee, shin, dysdiatokinesia, that sort of thing. But coordination or cerebellar, whichever you'd prefer. And also, just to come back to that serotonin syndrome, we have more serotonergic innervation to our lower extremities than upper extremities, so that's why we're looking for that increased tone in the lower extremities and the Clonus there, more than upper extremities. And my own approach to patients, as you described, Aaron, would be, you know, to try to see if they can respond to verbal stimuli, and if not, I'll usually do deep nail bed pressure in all 4 extremities to test both afferent and efferent limbs of the nervous system to see if they symmetrically can withdraw in all extremities, etc. For those of you out there listening, again, this is sort of a classic cholinergic toxidrome. And within the cholinergic toxidrome, there are really 3 subtoxidromes. There's the muscarinic toxidrome from the buildup of acetylcholine at the muscarinic receptors. And the preferred mnemonic that I like and that AHLS teaches is dumbbells. You can remember what lifts a dumbbell. Well, a muscle does, if that's helpful to memory. And that stands for diarrhea, urination, meiosis. And what we like to call the killer bees, an old skit on Saturday Night Live, bronchorrhea, excess secretion in the bronchioles, bronchospasm, those bronchioles, those respiratory bronchioles are small, and potentially bradycardia. Also emesis, lacrimation, a potentially fatal L, laryngospasm, and three S's, salivation, secretions, and sweating.
We have a lot of our residents that haven't even seen movies from the 90s, so if they recognize the killer bees from Saturday Night Live with John Belushi, I'd be very, very impressed. So.
Extra credit. There is also the nicotinic subsyndrome of the cholinergic toxidrome. In this one, I try to remember and teach how many days of the week does a smoker need their nicotine. They need them every day of the week. Mm-hmm. And this includes only the weekdays, not the weekends. Mm-hmm. And there are some polar opposites here. Mydriasis, the polar opposite of meiosis under the muscarinic. Tachycardia, the polar opposite of bradycardia under muscarinic. Weakness at the neuromuscular junction. Hypertension and fasciculations. Also, there can be hyperglycemia, not truly a sign, but a point-of-care lab test.
Mm-hmm. Probably more from, is this a direct thing from cholinergic activation, or is this more of a big cortisol surge from a big stress from being critically ill?
Well, as you remember, the muscarinic receptors about, in the brain, neuroreceptors, about 80% are muscarinic, about 20% nicotinic of the cholinergic types of neuroreceptors in the brain. And in the periphery, muscarinic are going to be smooth muscle glands and organs. But as we remember, the neuromuscular junction is going to be nicotinic, so the weakness and fasciculations are going to be at the neuromuscular junction. And also, as you remember, every ganglion in our body, whether sympathetic or parasympathetic, every ganglion has a nicotinic receptor there. Also, the sympathetic chain ganglia run down either side of the spine, and our adrenal glands are analogous to a sympathetic chain ganglion, and they have nicotinic receptors on our adrenal medulla. So out pours 80% epinephrine, 20% norepinephrine. So that really produces a direct fight or flight response with increased pressure, increased heart rate, glycogenolysis. If you're going to fight or flee, you've got to have fuel, and gluconeogenesis. So that's the basis for it. Also, the other sub-syndrome of the cholinergic toxidrome is central nervous system, CCC, not the Civilian Conservation Corps from the dirty 30s, but confusion, convulsions, and coma.
So right away, everything I learned in medical school is wrong, because you mentioned mydriasis, tachycardia is part of what will happen as a cholinergic sign and symptom. And immediately when I've learned, when I learned the kind of parasympathetic and sympathetic activation, I learned that they were polar opposites, but not necessarily the case. There is certainly some overlap, which is why the original presentation of this patient was confusing to me. This patient It's not bradycardic. This patient does seem confused and is having some bronchospasm, but you know, this must be something else because this patient has a normal heart rate.
Well, thanks for that lead-in, and we'll look at actually an old case series from the Journal of Pediatrics, and again, with you as a board-certified specialist in both emergency medicine and pediatrics, I wanted to bring in at least one pediatrics reference. And again, the course of the poisoning, there can be dynamic change. The patient can be tachycardic at one point, maybe early on, maybe they'll settle down in bradycardia. We've had patients alternate between the two. Again, meiosis is more common than mydriasis, but again, there's this dynamic interplay between effects in the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system. So in terms of breathing complications, we've looked at many of the signs and symptoms, but I do want to emphasize that airway resistance is proportional to 1 over the radius to the 4th power. And friends don't ask friends to do math in public, and physics wasn't my strong suit, but as the radius, as those bronchioles get smaller and tighter and full of mucus, their gas exchange radius goes to zero, and so airway resistance goes to infinity. Likewise, flow through those bronchioles is proportional to the radius to the fourth power. So again, if we can bronchodilate them, or if we can put in a larger ET tube if necessary, that'll be helpful. The resistance of a size 7 ET tube versus a size 8, the resistance is 1.7 times the resistance of a 8 ET for a 7 tube. And likewise, if you can increase your ET tube size from 7 to 8, your flow increases 1.7 times.
Yeah, the airway resistance Pusso's law that you have there is very near and dear to my heart as a pediatrician, because this is why we have croup instead of laryngitis, and this is why we have bronchiolitis instead of URIs. It's because you get those tiny tubes, and it only takes a little bit of gunk or airway resistance or bronchospasm to cause a lot of problems. So in a case that you're describing, anything you can do to help maximize that flow is going to be very helpful.
Yes. No, and thank you for teaching me, as you always do too, Aaron. I appreciate it. Also, in terms of CNS complications, this patient has an altered mental status. But remember that these organophosphate insecticides can cause seizures. And oftentimes when we say somebody's seizing, we see them actually having convulsions. But also, because these organophosphates can cause a buildup of acetylcholine at the neuromuscular junction, not only can people have fasciculations, but then flaccid paralysis. So somebody could be having cerebral seizure activity, and you would not be able to see convulsions. So in questions like this, it's important to get benzodiazepines on board, and if possible, to get bedside EEG if this is in your differential. In this case example we're giving, the patient isn't having that. He's got a Glasgow coma scale of 12. Other question: how common is cholinergic pesticide poisoning in the United States? We can look at data from the poison centers, and looking at Clinical Toxicology Journal from 2017, and there were almost 2,000 patients with organophosphate-only poisoning called into poison centers. Obviously, there are more than that. All poisonings aren't reported. And about a little over 25%, 28%, that is a little more than one in four of those called into poison centers, is treated in a healthcare facility. Of the large number, 6% have moderate morbidity, life-threatening morbidity about 1%, and less than 1% death. So it does occur, but as you said, this is less common in the U.S. and more common in developing countries.
Yeah, one of the reasons I really wanted to cover this is because it's something that all emergency physicians know about. You could look at this patient's case on a test, on your in-training exam or your ABEM recert, and say, oh, this is a cholinergic toxidrome patient. I can recognize it. In real life, it doesn't necessarily mirror exactly what you're going to see. And I think that the treatment aspect of it that comes afterward is what we're a little bit fuzzier on. So even just seeing that the death rate in this is very low takes a load off of my mind that likely I have time to call for help, and that I know enough to be able to keep someone alive until I can get some reserves or some get the cavalry in. So
yes, as you said, you know, if we do our primary survey and resuscitation, the basics, that gives us time to think about what's really going on with the patient, and how can we intervene specifically targeted. So one important thing in organophosphate poisoning, just as in myocardial infarction or stroke or shock, time is tissue. And here with organophosphate poisoning, we have an antidote that is time critical, and that is pralidoxime. And that's because the organophosphates bind irreversibly to cholinesterase unless pralidoxime is given prior to that aging. And aging, what is it? It's the average time for that irreversible binding to occur. Fortunately, it's a three-step process, and the first two steps of the binding are reversible. So acetylcholinesterase, the last five letters of that word spell erase. What does acetylcholinesterase do? It erases acetylcholine, the neurotransmitter at both these muscarinic and nicotinic receptors. And we can conceptualize it as nothing more than a biochemical scissors. Acetylcholinesterase is a scissors, and it splits acetylcholine in two. And actually, it does this faster than you can imagine it. Every animal species on this planet, acetylcholinesterase is the fastest enzyme. It's a character of an enzyme called Vmax, or maximum velocity. And it makes sense that those animals that had faster acetylcholinesterase left more offspring, and so it's just kind of a unique aside.
Interesting.
The organophosphates will bind in a three-step fashion to that acetylcholinesterase so that scissors cannot contract and cut the acetylcholine in two. The first interaction is weak electrostatic binding. It's an electron cloud interaction. Depending on your ancestry, you could call it van der Waals forces or London forces. But again, if you give pralidoxime here, it can regenerate the enzyme. If you wait, there's a reversible covalent bond that's formed. It's screwing it a little tighter to the enzyme, so to speak, in a figurative sense, but pralidoxime or other oximes can unscrew those screws and pry this off. But if you wait after the leaving group leaves, time is tissue, and that enzyme is gone and has to be regenerated.
So it's one of the downsides of having an audio podcast is you can't see the really impressive visual that is basically just a pair of scissors, but then it's a difference between putting a wrench in between the handle part of the scissors that you can just take out of the way with the weak bonds that you have initially, and then you've got the reversible bond where you've kind of screwed it into place, but you can take those screws out. It might take a little more doing versus what you have when you have an irreversible bond, is you've essentially welded that that wrench in place to where those scissors are never going to come back together. So how much time do you usually have in between those processes? The first, I imagine, happens very quickly. But what's the time until you start to get the reversible bond and then the irreversible bond?
So the average time for what we would consider would be dimethyl organophosphates on average is about 3.7 hours. Mm. And for diethyl organophosphates, it would be about 33 hours.
Okay.
So again, we're going to look at some studies that show the sooner that you give this, the better. Right. If possible, as soon as possible. Ideally within 2 hours of exposure.
Great.
The other reason is not only can pralidoxime regenerate the enzyme before it's aged, but pralidoxime also combines directly with your organophosphate. So if that organophosphate is in the bloodstream or tissues, you can deactivate it before it even binds.
And it's comforting again to know that it's over the course of hours and this isn't a seconds or minutes thing. I think that a lot of us when we were in medical school or even in residency, the antidote that we have the most experience with is probably naloxone, and I can at least admit that I figured every antidote must work like naloxone, where you see within a couple seconds it's going to work or it's not. And as emergency doctors, we're not the patient kind necessarily. We don't like to wait for answers. We don't like to wait for results. So it was a little frustrating with some of these antidotes that, no, this might take a little while actually, while the patient is still critically ill and you need to provide some good supportive care, but you do have a wider window than I would have guessed to actually get that treatment in.
Yes, thank you, Aaron. So I wanted to just address one more thing on the physical exam. What physical sign is paradoxically common in organophosphate insecticide poisoning? And you've already highlighted that, Aaron. But there was a study in pediatrics in 1988, and it looked at pediatric patients with both organophosphate and carbamate insecticide poisoning, both cholinergic types of poisons. And in that case series, 49% of the children had tachycardia and 19% had bradycardia, and obviously the others had a normal heart rate.
So over twice as many patients had tachycardia than the quote-unquote classic bradycardia.
Yes.
And some of them even had normal heart rates.
Exactly.
So everything you learned in medical school, you need to be willing to expand your brain a little bit outside of what you see, because these patients, whether they're tachycardic or bradycardic, may still benefit from treatment, correct?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Yes. And we understand, too, here about 1 out of 5 patients was bradycardic, and yet all were poisoned with either organophosphate or carbamate, and about half were tachycardic, and that leaves about 30% with a normal heart rate. Mm. So, and again, we talked about why the tachycardia, or why a normal heart rate with tachycardia and bradycardia balancing out. Again, that nicotinic stimulation at the adrenal medulla outpours epi, norepi, up goes heart rate.
I think that's an important medical pearl for emergency medicine of, if it's classic, then, you know, go for what's classic. But just because it's not classic doesn't mean that's not what's going on.
That's right. The nerve agents, the organophosphate nerve agents, are not insecticides. Tragically, in humans and humanity to other humans, these are homicidal agents. But in the Tokyo subway sarin attack, Akimura and his colleagues took care of patients that presented to St. Luke's Hospital. They had the largest single number of patients that day. And only 4 of 111 admitted patients with moderate to severe sarin organophosphate poisoning, a nerve agent, had bradycardia. So again, bradycardia really may be the exception rather than the rule. Mm. So this is your patient out there, whether you're driving in your car or however you're contemplating this podcast, and thanks for your time and attention and all you do for all your patients. When do you decontaminate skin of a patient poisoned with organophosphates? This patient ingested it. And what systematic approach do you use for skin decontamination? And would you treat this patient with pralidoxime? And if so, with which dosage regimen? And why would we even bring this up if it were such a settled question?
Right. This is the if this, do that kind of approach to antidotes and toxidromes. Well, if they have this, then you give this medication. I don't think that we often think about the side effect profiles of antidotes. Well, it's the antidote, so they need it. So why would this even be a question? But you actually bring up some interesting literature that shows this should be a question. There is some conflicting evidence, the same as how some may argue TPA is not the antidote for stroke across the board. There are patients that don't qualify. With decontaminating these patients, I think that's the last thing we think about as emergency physicians. We assume that EMS has already done a lot of this stuff. In a patient that's drank it, maybe not necessarily going to contaminate everyone else, but if you've got a patient who's coated in a powder or coated in a liquid and you start to develop your own symptoms because you haven't decontaminated them, it's a huge problem and you won't be able to care for anyone else. Even more so, you might take away resources because everyone's going to want to care for you.
Yes, excellent point, Aaron. And again, with ingestion, no proven efficacy for activated charcoal or gastric lavage in this setting. Sometimes patients are not fastidious or they do spill it on themselves. I do want to emphasize one thing. When these patients come in, oftentimes what you're smelling is the hydrocarbon diluent or carrier agent for these, and that these organophosphate insecticides have extremely low vapor pressures. So the vapor, they're not truly a vapor hazard, although you and your colleagues who are caring for them will smell that, but realize it is usually the hydrocarbon that is causing that smell and that symptomatology. Mm-hmm. So in advanced hazmat life support, we like to give people a fairly easy way to remember things. And so we've got a dry, wet, dry, or DWD mnemonic. Dry decon, if you see something spilled on their clothing, it could be emesis, etc. Remove the clothing, jewelry, shoes, a bag and tag, and remove from where healthcare providers are providing healthcare. And if you see visibly adherent solid, take a gauze or microfiber towel, etc., kind of surround it with both hands and lift it off. So gross decontamination in that way. We don't really want to brush it and suspend it so that you could inhale the aerosol, that is the powder, and that way you could become contaminated. And blot away any visibly adherent liquids. And then wet decon. Most of these organophosphates are not water soluble, and so good soap and water. Pay attention to skin and in skin folds. Things will build up there, just like intertrigo, and some of our patients with more folds than others. Some patients have more folds, and fluid in or debris can build up there. And then dry the patient to remove any desorbed organophosphate that you desorbed with the soap and water from superficial skin layers, and then dry that patient to prevent hypothermia. And again, as you said early on, Aaron, fundamentals are fundamental. The first thing many of us learned in our academics was the alphabet, A, B, C, D, E, and the same is true for us as emergency healthcare professionals. Airway, breathing, circulation, disability, meaning the nervous system, and then exposure with environmental control. And I also like the D you added for not only disability of the nervous system, but dextrose.
Yeah, I think it's important. I think it's important for us because, again, we always assume EMS has done it. Our pre-hospital people are wonderful about making sure they've checked that sugar. In the emergency department, it's often one of the last things we think of when the lab calls us for a critical value 1 hour later. It's a little bit embarrassing. So try to get it first. It's the fastest test you can get back in the ER.
Absolutely. Point of care, glucose or dextrose. Trust but verify. In terms of the primary survey and resuscitation in this patient with excess salivation or bronchorrhea, suction, and this sialorrhea, that is excess salivation or bronchorrhea, excess bronchial secretions, can respond to atropine. And you may need to use high-dose atropine. Obviously, folks with adequate spontaneous ventilation, we want to have good oxygenation. If we think we may be heading towards intubation, at least here in our hospital, we get 75 liters per minute out of the wall in oxygen, putting on a non-rebreather reservoir mask and turning it up to the maximum to pre-oxygenate with complete nitrogen washout. If they have an inadequate ventilation, obviously you're going to do bag valve mask ventilation for them and ventilate with 100% oxygen. And for intubation in this setting, and again, this patient doesn't need intubation, but any patient with organophosphate poisoning, we'd like to avoid succinylcholine. Succinylcholine sounds a lot like its congener, acetylcholine, and it is. And succinylcholine's broken down by pseudo or plasma cholinesterase. And so it's not that you can't use it. The patient will become paralyzed, but they'll be paralyzed a long time with their plasma cholinesterase inhibited. And so they may wake up and be paralyzed for many hours.
Which is a terrifying thing to do to a patient. I think that this is another setting where we start to wonder, well, this is a patient who's got a toxic ingestion and they overdose. What medications that I would normally use without even a second thought do I need to reconsider? And so something like succinylcholine in this patient, usually we think about, well, is there a hyperkalemia risk? Is there some other issue? But the thought of someone being paralyzed for a longer period of time because of the toxic ingestion is something that's might be an afterthought. And if it's an afterthought, you're going to be having to make sure that sedation is really, really heavy for a long time.
Excellent. Yes. And if possible, we'd usually recommend rocuronium. Treating hemodynamically significant bradycardia would be important too, and in this example case, we don't have it. Mm-hmm. And obviously, by hemodynamically significant, we mean low heart rate with low blood pressure, since cardiac output equals heart rate times stroke volume. Mm-hmm. Just a low heart rate alone isn't an indication for atropine, but this patient's bronchospasm, bronchorrhea, and secretions are.
And you notice you note that high doses may be not necessary. How high are we talking?
It depends when you catch the patient in their poisoning. If you can regenerate their enzyme or bind up the organophosphate with early pralidoxime, there's an atropine sparing effect because you don't have to block the acetylcholine if it's not there, if your enzyme can chew it up.
Fair enough.
But if somebody presents late or after aging, hundreds of milligrams of
hundreds
atropine.
Of milligrams.
Potentially. So not only do we have an ABCDE format for primary survey and resuscitation, but we can change an essay question, what do I do with this poison patient that's drunk the diazinon, into a multiple choice. Can I intervene pharmacodynamically or pharmacokinetically? A, can I alter absorption? That is DECON. We talked about it. A, can I administer antidotes? We have atropine for the muscarinic signs and symptoms, a competitive antagonist at muscarinic receptors only. So when you think of the three sub-syndromes of the cholinergic toxidrome, atropine is only anti-dumbbells. It can't make you strong again. It cannot regenerate your enzyme. Pralidoxime is potentially able to combine with unbound organophosphate so that it doesn't bind to enzyme, and also to regenerate unaged acetylcholinesterase. And so it's going to work where there are subjacent nicotinic and muscarinic receptors. And so it is the only thing that can reverse the fasciculations or the weakness if given in time. B is for basics, of course, your primary survey and resuscitation, which we did at first, and benzos for seizures, such as midazolam, like in the Rampart studies. There is no way to change catabolism, how the drug is broken down in the body, that or actually the organophosphate. There is no way to distribute it differently, other than hopefully binding it with pralidoxime. And there is no way to enhance the elimination of the organophosphates. In other words, hemodialysis would not be applicable. So then we get into, should we use pralidoxime or not? If you look at the package insert updated in 2008 and available on Daily Med from the National Library of Medicine, it says 1 to 2 grams repeated in 1 hour if weakness persists, and it doesn't give a specific loading dose. Olson's Poisoning and Drug Overdose 2018 and the HLS Provider Manual also suggest up to 2 grams repeated in 1 hour. As a bolus, and boluses get you where you want, drips keep you where you want, and up to 10 milligrams per kilogram per hour. Goldfrank's Toxicologic Emergencies 2015 suggests 30 milligram per kilogram load with a max of 2 grams and up to 10 milligrams per kilogram per hour, although they suggest potentially a max of 650 milligrams per hour. Many emergency physicians and other healthcare professionals will look it up to date. Dr. Stephen Bird, an outstanding emergency medicine physician and medical toxicologist, updated up to date. And he states, quote unquote, evidence about the use of oximes to treat organophosphate poisoning is inconsistent and difficult to interpret. Until this variability is better understood and other treatments become available, we believe all patients poisoned with organophosphate agents should be treated with an oxime. And he, in up to date, recommend greater than or equal to 30 milligrams per kilogram bolus and greater than or equal to 8 milligrams per kilogram per hour in adults. Poisondex says a very similar dosing regimen, and it states use of oxime is usually indicated for patients with moderate to severe toxicity and severe organophosphate poisoning with nicotinic, that is weakness, and or central nervous system manifestations such as coma or seizures should be treated with pralidoxime in addition to atropine. So these are some of the standard reference recommendations.
These are the ones that I would have available if I was in this situation, knew the right drug to give, but didn't know the dose.
Let's look at some of the studies. Why is there any controversy at all? Power et al. In Lancet in 2006 looked at 100 patients in a study group and 100 in a control group. Both groups, study and control, got 2-gram bolus, and their patients, their median time to presentation was 2 hours for the study group, 1.9 for the control. And the study group, after the 2-gram bolus of pralidoxime, got a constant infusion at 1 gram per hour for 48 hours. The control group got intermittent 1 gram every 4 hours for 48 hours. And again, it should be noted, this is pralidoxime iodide, not the pralidoxime chloride we use here in the States. And the median atropine dose was much less in the study group with the constant infusion at 6 grams versus 30 grams for the control group. This was statistically significant. Patients needing intubation in the study group were about two-thirds versus almost 90% in the control group, again, statistically significant. And the duration of intubation was half, 5 days versus 10 days, also statistically significant. And the percentage of deaths was 1%, similar to the U.S. data, and these patients were cared for in ICU, versus 8% in the control group, also statistically significant. So looking at these data makes me want to use pralidoxime. What are your thoughts, Aaron?
Seems like you've got a relative risk reduction. Sounds like a great drug. I don't see the problem. Until.
Until. Very, very smart other friends and colleagues, Dr. Edelston and others, studied pralidoxime and acute organophosphate poisoning. This is published in PLOS Medicine in 2009. They used a study group of 121 patients, and again, randomized. Control group, 114. The study group got a 2-gram pralidoxime bolus, and the control group did not get any pralidoxime. They got supportive care, atropine. After the 2-gram bolus in the study group, they got a constant infusion at 500 milligrams per hour, less than the POWER study. But again, this was pralidoxime chloride here. Time to presentation, this was in Sri Lanka, and the median time was much longer, 4.3 hours for the study group, 4.4 for the control. And there's no difference between the study and control group in those needing intubation. Or the number or the percentage of deaths, no statistically significant. There was a difference in duration of intubation, but there are actually more deaths, and therefore this may have influenced the duration of intubation. But basically, their study said, hey, we don't find pralidoxime beneficial.
So now it seems like a worthless drug. Why would anyone give this?
So let's move on. Edelston and Buckley and others did a Cochrane review and included their study and other previous studies. And basically their conclusion out of that Cochrane review in 2011 was that current evidence at that time was insufficient whether oximes are harmful or beneficial, and that the World Health Organization 30 milligram per kilogram standard bolus and 8 milligrams per kilogram per hour was not supported by their review, and that further randomized controlled trials were needed. So we'll look at a few. Chaudhary published in Toxicology International in 2013, and they had a study group that got a 30 milligram per kilogram bolus, but intermittent IV bolus, not a constant infusion like POWER. And the control group got no pralidoxime, and they really found no difference in mean atropine dose, in needing intubation, duration of admission or deaths. But again, in this study, their mean time to presentation was well over 5 hours. So again, time is tissue. We'd like to get these antidotes on early.
Right.
Banerjee also published on this, Journal of Postgraduate Medicine 2014, 60 people in each group. The study group got 1 gram pralidoxime bolus and intermittent IV bolus, not the constant infusion of POWER. Control group got no pralidoxime. Their patients also presented relatively late, median time over 4 hours in both groups. And really there was no difference in deaths or intubation. The pralidoxime group had a longer duration mean of hospital admission, 7 days versus almost six. Syed found similar results in the Saudi Journal of Anesthesia in 2015. They used the WHO 30 milligram per kilogram bolus and constant infusion at 8 mg per kg per hour. The control group got nothing, and they found no difference in need of intubation, atropine dose, or deaths. But their patients also presented median times in both groups more than 5 hours after ingestion. So those all have not shown support. This study by Liu in the Journal of Chinese Medical Association in 2015, two groups, 30 patients each. They were all critically ill, all were intubated, and cared for in intensive care units. Pralidoxime bolus, 2 grams for each. And the experimental group got a constant infusion at 8 mg per kg per hour versus intermittent bolus. Their patients presented median time within an hour and a half. And they had a marked reduction in deaths. 10% of their patients died in the control group with a bolus and constant infusion of pralidoxime versus 26.7, almost three times as much in the control group, and this was statistically significant. They also needed less atropine in the study group. Dr. Lin in Taiwan published in the Biomedical Journal in 2016, and they had a little different. They used a 2-gram bolus in both their study and control groups, and a constant infusion at 1 gram per hour if the Apache score was greater than or equal to 26, or they didn't regenerate the plasma cholinesterase, versus a constant IV infusion of 500 milligrams per hour in the control group. And the median total atropine dose wasn't statistically different, nor were the percentage needing intubation, but again, much less deaths in their bolus and constant infusion group with the high dose, 1 gram per hour, which would go along with the 10 milligrams per kilogram per hour suggestions by many in the standard references. And their deaths, less than 5% versus almost 30% in the control group.
That's a huge reduction.
Yes, and all these are statistically significant.
So if I had to kind of summarize some of this, it seems like pralidoxime is going to be most efficacious if it's given as an IV infusion, if it's going to be given at the higher dose that you described, and in sicker patients who are intubated and are more critically ill.
Easy to teach smart people. And thank you for teaching me and inviting me to participate today.
So this was a real case.
This is a real case.
What did you do?
Okay, so this patient who presented after drinking the diazinon. It looked as if he may have spilled some on himself. We gave him soap and water decon. We discarded all his clothing. He got albuterol and oxygen initially, and then IV atropine titrated to resolve his wheezing and his prolonged inspiratory to expiratory ratio. It was prolonged at 1 to 3. We want that at 1 to 2. We gave him a 2-gram pralidoxime chloride IV bolus, and we gave him a 10 milligram per kilogram per hour continuous IV infusion. He had no muscarinic signs or symptoms after 24 hours. We stopped the atropine. Pralidoxime was also discontinued, but after 6 hours, he developed some facial fasciculations, and so we rebolused the pralidoxime, gave him a continuous infusion, and we successfully discontinued that at 48 hours. He had a normal exam. He had stable plasma and RBC cholinesterase levels for 24 hours off pralidoxime, and he had no recurrence of nicotinic or muscarinic or central nervous system signs or symptoms. We discharged him home after 72 hours in the poison center. Actually, he got discharged to psychiatry, the poison center followed him at the psychiatric hospital.
That's fantastic.
Well.
Success. So, in summary, this is something that is not often seen, but when it does, it's very time dependent. We have a couple resources. We can use atropine. We can use pralidoxime. Pralidoxime seems to be more efficacious in sicker patients. And when in doubt, call 1-800-222-1222. Thank you very much for joining us on the podcast, Frank. It's really nice to kind of go through one of these cases and kind of nitpick it to a degree so we can talk about some of these finer points and something that we don't get to see all the time. So if anyone is interested in hearing more of this or any of the other lectures that Dr. Walter and his course have, www.ahls.org. Frank, thank you very much for joining us today.
Aaron, thank you for having me. It's been my pleasure and privilege.
Hi, everyone. It's Brian Drummond. I'm on the other side again today doing the peer review for the organophosphate talk. So Frank Walter did a great job explaining organophosphate poisonings and what things you should look for and what things you should know. He reviewed the literature and did a really nice job. So I'm not going to have too much to say about Aaron and Frank's job. I think they did a really good job. So instead, I'm going to try to just give a summary and then a quick military perspective from my experiences with this. There's two types, right? There's either a nerve agent or an organophosphate pesticides are the two ways you're going to come into this kind of toxidrome. So the nerve agents that you may be exposed to and hopefully are never exposed to are Tobin, Sarin, Somin, and VX gas. The other way you could have a patient that's exposed to this would be carbamates like industrial chemicals or organophosphate pesticides. And the organophosphate pesticides will most likely be on your board test. Just about every board test, and I just took my recertification recently, organophosphates were on that as well. So when you're thinking about these, how do you do it? Well, your history is really going to guide your exposure. If someone just comes in and they say, well, I have some vomiting, diarrhea, and they're not around chemicals, and they don't work in an industrial setting, and they haven't been around strange gas or a military or combat zone, you're probably not worrying as much about these. So let the history guide you. And if they say, I consumed this thing, I was trying to kill myself, and you find out what that chemical is, then you want to think about it. So a good history should help guide you when you're starting to see a collection of symptoms that aren't making sense. And then when you think about this in a patient, the big things I look for is if someone's just having secretions everywhere, right? That's how it was taught to us in the military. I learned the sludge, not the dumbbells mnemonic. And when there is liquid coming out of your eyes, your nose, your mouth can be drooling and vomiting. Your lungs are spilling liquid, your skin spilling liquid, and even your butt spilling liquid. So liquid's coming out everywhere, not so good. That's when I want to think about this kind of toxidrome. And then with all that liquid release, eventually you can get to mental status changes, weakness, and seizures. So think about this and liquid coming out everywhere in the body. So what do you do? Well, there's not too much to do. It's very simplified, kind of a stepwise approach. The first thing is going to be safety. Safety for you, safety for your ER, safety for those around you. And Frank talked about this. And the first thing will be a gross decontamination. So if you see a dry powder or a liquid, dry rags, you're using gloves, you hopefully have done some personal protective gear, and you want to wipe that up and put it in a bag and get it out of the emergency room. Then, after you grossly decontaminated someone, you want to remove all their clothes and, again, bag them. Again, so there's no off-gassing or leaking of fluid out of the bag and into the clothes and onto the floor so someone else won't be exposed. Once the clothes are removed from the patient, you're going to want to use soap and water. And as Frank said, that'll help break down the chemicals. You decontaminate them, and then you've just made them wet. So now you need to dry them and dry them off, and so they don't get hypothermia, but also removing any extra chemicals that are there. So safety is the first thing. The second thing you want to do is save your anticholinesterase inhibitors. So you want to use TUPAM or prilosexam. The earlier is better. Frank did a nice job going through the research on this. It sounds like there was both pros and cons. The one thing I didn't hear too much about was, is there any harms of giving TUPAM? Now, my training in the military was there really isn't a harm of giving TUPAM or side effects. So go ahead and give it because it may be a benefit. So that was something that may be missing in the discussion, but harms of TUPAM are pretty low. And in someone who's pretty sick, either with an ingestion or a poisoning of this kind, you probably want to give the TUPAM. The third thing you want to do is you give atropine until they're dry. So if they got liquid coming out of different places, you keep giving atropine. And this isn't the ACLS dosing of, well, I've given 2 milligrams of IV atropine. That's probably enough. I should stop. As Frank said, you will go to very high doses with this. So there really isn't an upper limit of atropine. You're just going to give it until they're dry. The fourth thing I worry about in this and to take care of these patients would be protecting the airway and lungs. So they're going to have bronchospasm and bronchorrhea. Give them some albuterol to help open up the airways and consider endotracheal tube and a big endotracheal tube as opposed to a smaller diameter. Again, trying to decrease that resistance. Fifth thing would be if they're seizing, you're going to give benzos. So for seizures, benzos. Sixth thing, they've had a bunch of secretions coming everywhere. I would give them some IV fluids and try to get their volume status resuscitated. The seventh thing you're probably going to do with these is admit the patient to the intensive care unit and continue the supportive care. So pretty simple. First thing, safety. Second thing, TUPAM, trying to save whatever acetylcholinesterase is still working. Three will be atropine until they're dry. Fourth, protect the airway and lungs, albuterol, and a large endotracheal tube if you need it. Five, for seizures, give them benzos. IV fluids replacements is number six. And number seven, admit them to the ICU and continue the supportive care. So that's kind of it for this toxidrome. There's not much else I have to add there. I just wanted to share my military experience. So I was in OIF 1 and 2 in 2003 and 2004 in Iraq as a general medical officer. And during that first time when we did the initial push into Iraq and invasion, we were issued, and I had to oversee this for my Marine battalion, was issuing out Mark 1 kits. So Mark 1 kits are it's two auto-injectors. The first auto-injector is atropine at 2 milligrams per injector. And the other part of the Mark 1 kit is we called TUPAM, or pralidoxime, and that was 600 milligrams. Those would become snapped together in a little foam packet. And we would issue those, three of those, to every Marine that was out there, with the thought that maybe sarin gas was going to be used at the time, so we wanted to be protected against this. So every Marine would have three of these so that they could give up to three doses, which would be up to 6 milligrams of atropine and 1,800 milligrams of TUPAM to their buddy or themselves if they felt that they were exposed. Now, mind you, give auto-injectors to Marines. Sometimes they go off randomly, and we didn't really have any harms from people injecting themselves with atropine or TUPAM, even if they weren't exposed. But that's what was issued to all of us. And the other part of the Mark I kit is the CANA, which stands for the Convulsant Antidote for Nerve Agent. And the CANA is Valium. And so it's a Valium auto-injector at 10 milligrams. And that was given, one of those was given to every Marine or sailor that was in the conflict as well. So if you had an exposure, you were to take the atropine, which is the smaller of the two auto-injectors, and it's in the number one slot, and you would apply that one first. Just like you would for other auto-injectors you teach your patients, like an EpiPen, we did this through the clothing to the lateral thigh. And then you would apply the TUPAM, which was the larger injector, or number two in the Mark I kit. And so that's what we had. Luckily, we were never exposed to chemical weapons that we know of, but we were prepared, and that was my first exposure to this kind of toxidrome and getting into it. So just a little bit of military history and what your EMS providers, as well as your hazmat and other people, may have on scene if you come across a large contamination or some mass casualty event. Hopefully that never happens. And I hope everyone had some good turkey and enjoyed a great Thanksgiving. And we'll talk to you next month. Bye.